And that's right, it is the Arts Report, and it's the 12 hours of student power. We are going to have some student power later in the hour, but we have a very exciting interview with Patrick Sampler talking about his new release, To the Stoning Lifted.
He creates this outcry, this clamor. He creates this nightmare of noise.
If it makes noise, it has some merit.
He's a sonic mess, basically. The discordant notes are just a hubbub, a cacophony.
If it makes noise, it has some merit.
He creates a disturbance because he's basically disturbed.
If it makes noise, it has some merit.
Basically, this is a worthless racket. The man is mentally incompetent.
For the most ear-splitting forays into noise, prog, early industrial, no wave, plunderphonic, psych, and altogether way out sound. Tune into A Noise with your host Luke Meat every Wednesday from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
And that was some Patrick Sampler on one of our older shows, A Noise.
Yeah, well, actually, in the background for that that advertisement for the show, a little bit later in it, there's someone who comes on and starts screaming wildly and announces a vocal solo, and that was from the Doopobs, which is a band that I was and I guess am still involved with.
And the Doopobs are they focus on regressive music, correct?
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about regressive music? And I kind of, for me, it seemed a little bit connected to outsider music, but from a different angle.
Yeah, thanks.
Can you explain that a little bit for me and my listeners?
Sure. I think it may be a subgenre of outsider music, but the whole term outsider music is pretty broad. So, you know, the one thing that it has in common with outsider music is that it is subverting or ignoring the conventions of popular music, but it's a little bit more specific. The whole idea of outsider music is extremely broad, although occasionally it does seem to be used to refer to a specific kind of sound.
It's kind of people who work outside the conventional modes of the industry and also songwriting in general. They're kind of working outside these structures that influence the production of art, not just the distribution.
Yeah, and so that encompasses a whole lot of things, whereas regressive is a bit more specific than that.
Okay.
It's a term that we coined, well, the Doopobs coined for our manifesto of regressive music. And it has the way of making music is quite distinctly prescribed through the manifesto. For example, none of the songs can be pre-written.
Mm.
We start with a title and then without having any idea of what the music is going to be like. And the song has to be recorded and written in no longer than it takes to play. And the songs have to have a chorus, which is generally the title of the song repeated four times. The verses have to be contentless. So we're basically regurgitating regular conventional popular music.
And so the reason that I'm having you on today is because of your release that is happening officially on Saturday, To the Stoning, Leftist Erotica, stories by Patrick Sampler. And it ties in, and you're also doing a Buto reading, which I thought was really interesting. We've done some interviews with Kokoro Dance before, with Barbara, and so that was interesting to me. And then after listening to your music, it all ties together, for me, in a way, in this idea of almost unmusic, undance. Like, Buto, your short stories and the music that you perform all seem to play with and poke fun of the conventions of the art that you're doing, but also the way that the conventions of that art were built by society. So, like, surrealist writing, which is what your writing is, very much pokes fun at the absurdity of the world that it's writing within.
Exactly. So the surrealist movement came about as social criticism, and one of the main points that was being made, among others, was that the unreasonableness of the so-called real world is no more is equally unreasonable as the unreasonableness of our subconscious and the world we live in when we're dreaming. And so the surrealists, especially the guy who wrote the Manifesto of Surrealism.
André Breton?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, schooling. Yeah. Nailed it.
Yeah, education is great. You can reference a lot of things. So basically he's saying that the so-called real world is just as unreasonable. So there is, it's equally valid to be absurd in the way you express yourself as it is to use language in a concrete way.
Well, what I thought before we get a little bit deeper was we can play a reading that has been produced by you of Kans. Can you pronounce that for me?
Kansai Airport.
Kansai Airport. And so this brings together the music and your art, as well as the Japanese influence and the words all together. So I thought if we play this, it gives people a little bit of an idea of your aesthetic, and then we can come back and play some more music and talk about the Buto reading.
Sounds good.
Okay, let's do it.
I board the Bay 11 bus from Kansai Airport to Okat. It's less expensive than the train, and more private, too. My need for privacy is summed up well by a Monty Python adage on the value of not being seen. The seats are covered in festive design plush, something like gift wrap for a child's birthday present. Yet the fireworks and gymnastic ribbons are perhaps not meant to cheer, but to blend with stains. As the manual transmission grinds on a few shifts, we get up to speed over the bridge, merely a road raised on posts in the water. Cool humidity seeps into the cabin, and through my window, a sun circle fades into the gray distance. A country girl, she can't be over 20, presents herself on flat screen monitors, one to each seat back. With great humility, we express our gratitude for your condescending to ride the Shintetsu Okat bus. We humbly provide this information broadcast for your safety and convenience. If you are over the age of 20 and would like to see my bare breasts for the remainder of this announcement, please swipe your Unicard in the seat back card payment reader ahead of you. Your monitor will be switched to privacy mode. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin. I know the trouble bare breasts have caused me. So instead, I take in the portside landscape of refinery flares, cooling towers, spherical hospital green gas canisters, and warehouse-like structures bulging with vein pipes. Untrained in the appreciation of such architecture, I wonder at the purpose. Perhaps not the scene for a romantic overture by Carl Maria von Weber. That sentiment for elsewhere, days of pantheistic rapture long past. The contrast would be too heavy, yet there is a naive filter for everything. I find my media player and ponder what to select. Scrolling down the view screen, I find Never Took Off, Undiscovered Industrial New Wave. I put on my headphones and select track number 13, theme for a band called Fashion Scientists.
Left behind superficial items of passion, you don't react. Just inseminated and leave-taking, make a whining bag of excrement. Cements, vision in the monitor view, a two-way screen, merely a test victim in the fashion of science. Just a moment of frozen lies in the science of fashion. Everything is frozen in a moment of lies. Really, it's the pointillated 16th note hi-hats and dramatic bass synth that make it. The vocals are sunk down in a wash of reverb and keyboard line, obscuring the lyrics that are, I must admit, quite shitty. The kind of shit even M could come up with. Although that's not quite right. Her style is more overwrought commercial Valentine's card, sick and fatally obsessive. M, who now reverts to a screen name she used around the time we met, just 2 months before we were married. That was crazy. But if only the prenuptials meant something here. Back to the seat-back monitors, where a young model, in the uniform of a stewardess, or without if you opt for the pay service, points out and recommends for one's next visit all the conveniences of Kansai Airport. This is followed by an aerial view. Surrounded by its offshore wall, the airport is an island within a moat within an island. Water continuously pumped outside to offset the effect of runways sinking while water levels rise. As the camera pans across the runway, various advertisements pop up on the screen. IKEA, McDonald's, Family Mart. Then more ads with seemingly little relevance to bus passengers. A factory that shrink wraps industrial cargo. A company that develops electrostatic paint spray technology. A manufacturer of missile guidance systems. Returning to the side window, I glance at the reflection of my face. Clearly, European features framed in a blonde fringe. So much for not being seen. Past that, I see we've entered central Osaka, if indeed it has a center. In any direction, a monotony of 18-story, multi-level highways and convoluted off-ramps. Shoebox apartments crammed within. Laundry hung out for exhaust fume saturation. What's the point? I imagine a chemical to dissolve the land masses. Along with the chemicalized sludge, most human construction would slide into the oceans. But Osaka's concrete, plastic, and steel, so distant from geology, would remain above sea level, left to stand like the metal plumbing of a woodhouse burned to the ground. A text message picked up on my unicard scrolls across the seat-back screen. Is someone else reading it too? Forgive me for taking so long to contact you. Due to psychological trauma, I will be unable to meet you for the time being. Signed, Destiny. I take out my handset and reply. Whose psychological trauma, and for how long? I wait a minute or two, but there is no answer. So I continue. I've brought your heirloom. Don't you want it? She replies, the spirit of my ancestors. Yes. You took them. No, you left them. I don't need them now. Don't forget your promise, I write, and the custody agreement. She responds, you weren't even here to name him. Him? And then no answer again, this time for perhaps 5 minutes. I have little time here, I continue. At least let me remember what you look like. Still, there is no answer, and I'm frustrated. I should never have overlooked your poor taste. Anyone with the screen name Destiny surely lacks an understanding of many, many things. Do your better traits have no meaning?
Listen up, fellow students, readers, and patrons of the UBC Bookstore. This upcoming November 27th, our beloved bookstore is hosting their very own Res Night for all UBC students. They'll be treating you to a night of free snacks to keep that brain fed, gaming, music courtesy of DJ Ochre, and need I mention, crazy discounts on books and supplies. Watch me be there stacking up on pencil cases. We're kicking the night off at 5 p.m., and for more info, check out the website at bookstore.ubc.ca.
The
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
And we are back on the Arts Report with Patrick Sampler, author of the collection of dystopian, surrealist, Japanese-inspired, To the Stoning Leftist Erotica. And this will be officially released on Saturday at Visual Space, pardon me. So that's November 24th. There will be a Buto accompaniment. And we actually do have three copies to give away. So if you want to give us a call at 604-822-2487 or shoot me an email at arts@citr.ca, we can definitely hook you up with a pre-proof copy. So it's all got all the original typos and stuff. It'll be a collector's edition. And I'm sure Patrick would deign to add his signature to that as well. And we were just joking about the PSAs that you just heard. Read a book, obviously. And also open media's call to prevent privacy invasion through our various media technologies. And you were saying, Patrick, that that connects to a book that you studied a Japanese author for your master's, and that very much inspired your writing. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the author I focused on was Abe Kobo, or usually in English, Kobo Abe, but in Japanese, the surname comes first. And the book that I was most interested in of his is called Secret Rendezvous. And when we were talking earlier, you mentioned Franz Kafka's The Castle. And it's a book which is actually quite similar to that, in that it's about someone trying to access a bureaucracy and having all sorts of roadblocks put in their way, and the absurdity of the way that system works. And I don't just mean absurd in the regular pejorative sense, but in the absurd in terms of attempting to attain a goal but never reaching it, but constantly moving forward. And it fits in with that PSA as well, because the novel Secret Rendezvous deals with the society of a hospital in which the patients are subjected to surveillance. In fact, their sex acts are recorded, and then the tapes of their sex noises are then sold to make profit for the hospital. And there's also a story into the stoning where actually it was sort of a challenge I made for myself, using all of the typical elements of an Abe Kobo novel and integrating them into a short story. And it's called A Haircut During the Resistance, which is about someone sort of the opposite kind of scenario, because they're being pursued and they're trying to keep ahead of their pursuer. And it was inspired also by the surveillance that was happening leading up to the 2010 Winter Olympics, and the activists who were being basically stalked by the police and being harassed into keeping their mouths shut. So the idea of the scariness of surveillance is certainly a part of the kind of absurd bureaucratic and totalitarian kind of a system. It's very real, and it's also interesting subject matter for surreal fiction.
Yeah, I mean, your stories they have a dystopian, we've said that a couple of times, and a surrealist. I mean, what I honestly felt, even said it out loud to myself at one point when I was just finishing the book, was like, this is like reading a David Lynch movie. So especially since it's short stories and the tone carries across all the stories, but the characters are almost cipher-like. And so there's a lack of kind of concrete awareness of their gender or their social place. All you get is kind of their surroundings in this short excerpt of their journey. And so reading them as a whole, it very much felt like that disconnection. And the other thing that you mentioned was that you were trying to, and with your work in general, escape the ideas of formula and virtuosity. And that's what drew you to Buto as well, and why you think it's going to be paired well with your reading. Can you tell me a little about escaping formula and virtuosity?
Yeah. So in terms of Buto, certainly there is virtuosity in Buto. However, there's also freedom for improvisation, and there's an ability for people who are new to the form to be involved and to be Buto dancers. And that's because Buto doesn't rely on a specific set of dance steps like other forms of dance do. There's something called Buto notation, which is more or less like poetry. And as a Buto dancer, you have the freedom to enact that, the image that you're given in the way you choose. So for example, I've taken a number of Buto workshops both here and in Japan briefly, and you'll be given instructions such as you have no pants on and you're walking on a glass floor and there are lots of people below you looking up, and you have to enact that as a Buto dancer, that the essence of how that feels. Or you have to, something like walking across the room as slowly as you possibly can, imagining that tiny people are tending wheat fields on your calves and things like that. And so that's how Buto notation works. And so it doesn't tell the dancer exactly how they need to move. And that also fits in with the doo-pops and the regressive music that I've worked on before, in that we're getting away from, we're satirizing, but also the formula of popular music, but also providing a lot of freedom for musicians to express themselves in the way they like. In the book, in terms of character, something that really impressed me recently that I read is a book called Reality Hunger by David Shields, and he talks about the novel and says that it's a tired
8787 or shoot myself an email at arts@citr.ca. We are also fairly open to giving away some tickets for the next run of Dancing at Lufthansa. And if you did not hear my description last week, or if you're like, that was not enough, Megan, I need more, then you're in luck, because we have Nicole Kai here to talk a little bit about the show, and she interviewed one of the performers as well as the director, John Cooper. So I just wanted to thank Patrick Sampler for coming by. He's signing books as we speak. And Nicole,
yep.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the show Dancing at Lufthansa?
Okay. So Dancing at Lufthansa is it's a play that's set in County Donegal in 1936. So that's in Ireland. And it's supposed to be a very moving play. And it's semi-autobiographical of the playwright, Brian Friel. It's about his childhood when his aunts, the five Muddy sisters, and his mother all lived under the same roof. So I interviewed director John Cooper. He's a UBC MFA directing alumnus, and he's award-winning, and he teaches stage directing here at theater at UBC. And the interview actually took place on the set of the play. And the first thing I noticed was the very elaborate stage settings. So I asked him to comment on the significance of the set with regards to this play.
All right, so here's the first excerpt from the interview with Nicole Kai and John Cooper for Dancing at Lufthansa.
So this started as these three beams and a low oppressive ceiling with the big cross on there. There's one of the dialectical arguments in the play is between governing religion and a more organic paganism. And so the women that live in this house here are people caught between the two. And so as it still does to this day, the church has a fairly big thumb on the people, right? And not my place to judge it, but just it seems to be a fact, as recently evidenced by that woman dying in the hospital in Galway. So we have this weight of them amongst this spirited group of young women living within this, and although some of them are trying to stay in the spirit of this, that need to be vibrant, celebratory, tied to the rituals of harvest and fertility, as they're just starting to turn over to the non-fertile part of them, of their journeys. It makes for an interesting dialectic, and I guess you can see where the sympathies lie a little bit with the crushing weight of that thing about to topple on them. But then outside, there's another whole part of the story is based on the brother has come back from 30 years of service in Africa, and he's a priest, and he's going to, in their minds, change their life around, because one of the gals has had a kid out of wedlock. So they've lots of shame and stuff, but the priest comes home, it's all going to be great, but he's kind of gone over to the other side by spending all the time in Uganda, and now he believes in all the pagan rituals from there. And so you will see evidence of it in the floor there, in the paint job there, on the projected piece up there, in the grain structures, and that are these shapes that appear both in Celtic mythology and in the Ugandan mythology. And there's lighting stuff that also backs that up a little bit. So that I think the argument is that there's a larger context for this paganism. It's not just some bunch of riotous, young, drunken hoodlums up in the hills of Northern Ireland. It's actually these festivals have long ancient traditions of drinking and dancing and trance and celebration that is also attuned to the life spirit. So it's the life spirit, in an argument between, control and release, or obedience and insurrection, and order and collapse, because the play also is set in a time of change. So how do you work through times of change be it, you know, literal or figurative. You know, I think in my own life, I think about death and how do you negotiate that kind of change, and how does, what kind of spiritual help are you looking for to negotiate walking through that time of change? And does a governing religion best suit you, or does a more organic spirituality serve you better? What, you know, so it's just asking questions that way.
So something that's also very interesting is that I asked the director what the primary appeal of this play was to him as a director, and his answer was, surprisingly, the concept of subversion. I also asked him to comment on how he or the audience can relate to the characters in the play, and he went on to talk about theater as a way of cultivating compassion and empathy for both for others and for ourselves.
There's entertainment and there's art, and art wants to invite us to view something from another perspective, an alternative angle. We hadn't seen it before, to allow us a new appreciation. And part of this piece of art is asking questions. Not all are, but many are. I certainly enjoy content. So if they're asking questions, then that's just another level of appreciation. Lest it sound like this is some, you know, heady affair. It's about a bunch of young women wrestling, a couple of them wrestling with getting older, and they want to dance, they want to, you know, live in their bodies and be real. And there's romance in the play and comedy, and you know, there's all kinds of fabulous things going on. It's not a dreary event, but, you know, on a deeper under level of it all, these are the implicit questions of it. This play has lots of levels of appreciation. Somebody can come in with one set of concerns and just enjoy, you know, the story of these strong young women out in the middle of nowhere trying to get along as five sisters with the men that came bouncing around through their lives. That's just a great story in itself, and I can take that as just an entertaining night. But I think because the play invites us to get close to them and then feel with them as they go through change, that we get pulled into maybe some other levels of experience that are satisfying in a more sustaining way. It challenges everybody, and myself included. It's got a lot of different textures and tones. You know, it starts out as a kind of poetic drama, and then all of a sudden it's funny and we're having a great time, and then we're into more, oh, it's getting darker in tone, and hey, yeah, now there's some romance, and then, oh, it's really changing. It ends up this kind of like Chekhov play at the end. It's like, how the heck did that happen? It's just really great Irish storytelling, but full of ironies, which are really, irony's challenging. I mean, I appreciate irony. I grew up with it, but two-sidedness is not easy to talk about sometimes, you know, which is what irony is, I think. You know, it's the simultaneous opposites. And so pulling the ironies out is always challenging. Having people who don't necessarily view the world ironically, inviting them into that headspace and to be able to deliver that. It's got lots and lots of fabulous challenges, but the words are so magnificent and the structure of the words is so, you know, artful that, you know, it's just a joy. It's a fine piece of writing. I got really excited about it. It was a fabulous project to work on. I knew it would be. And, it was very exciting and really satisfying. Well, I'm a bit rebellious myself. I think it's that whole idea that of subversion that the priest brings it, the priest who's gone over to African spirituality brings into this structure that's teetering. I saw this play, I don't know, 20 something years ago in London, and you know, I don't remember too much about it other than that really stuck with me. And, you know, one or two visual moments that I remember about the play. Not too much other than that stayed with me. But I did remember that this whole subversive other spiritual system coming in and offering hope, and that it was a tragedy to it as well, in that, you know, in time of change, it's 1936, it's the world was changing quickly then, and the agrarian economy was giving way to a more industrial economy, and there's casualties, and these really neat young women full of vigor and conflict and all inner turmoil and questions that I can relate to as a fella here in Canada, let alone, I'm sure the women in the room even have more affinities, you know, it's good human being stuff. So it's strong characters, conflicted, and with nice subversive questions. I think because the nature of the job is I have to invest in all their stories. If I came just to see it, you know, it might be, there's a gal who's handicapped to, you know, is a rebellious spirit, and so I like her. But there's the woman who's the de facto matriarch of the family, who has to carry all the burdens of everybody and be the mom and bear all the burdens at a cost to herself, or feels she must. I don't know if she has to, but she feels she must. I can relate to that as well. You know, the young girl who just wants to escape and and have a normal life. I can relate to that. You know, I grew up in the country and it didn't fulfill my needs, and you know, I can relate to yearning. There's the older gal who's the comic, who makes fun and tries to negotiate everything through humor. Well, I can relate to that too. So they're all parts of self, right? We have many dimensions to ourselves. So, you know, it's a chance to pull out all your alter egos and trot them around. You know, or not really. I mean, it's these women doing it. But I get to relate to all parts. There's stuff that I really like. And, you know, if my job is to defend all the people, I get a chance to go, well, hey, those people who try to run things, who have control issues and all that stuff, maybe I ought to be more generous towards them, because, you know, they're obviously coming from a place of fear and they have the same needs and wants and everything. They're just caught in some other thing, you know, and I've been lost many times in my life, so I'm sympathetic, you know. So it's really too easy. They're compelling characters and contradictory and easy for me to empathize with. One of those little showbiz rules is you got to defend the characters. Even the person who's acting the fool, or who's seemingly outside of your sympathies, they themselves have their own inner dialogue that somehow we want to have some compassion for. You know, the famous one, I guess, being Malvolio in Twelfth Night, who, you know, becomes this object of ridicule and modern interpretations played out, like, you know, in such a way that we're invited to have compassion towards him, even though he's been the, you know, governing patriarchal fool. So, yeah, I think it's a more complex understanding of reality now that even the idiot's good to somebody and loved by somebody, and he doesn't think he's being an idiot, he thinks he's doing the right thing. I know this because I'm that idiot sometimes.
We're all that idiot.
Yeah, well, that's the beauty, right? So we can be more compassionate to others and to ourselves. And because we sit in the dark with strangers and witness these things collectively, we reintegrate with our herd mentality and, you know, hopefully walk out a bit more compassionate, kinder, less self-critical, with some entertainment under our belt and maybe a few new questions to carry forth into our evening, right?
That sounds pretty interesting. It looks like it's looking a lot at the idea of trying to escape, and yet at the same time, a bit of nostalgia at the same time.
Yeah, it's a lot. There's this conflict or struggle between two ideologies. This one that's brought back from one of the brothers who was away at Africa, and the ones at home in Ireland. So yeah. And I also had the chance to interview Emma Johnson, who plays the youngest sister in the play.
And her name and the character's name is Chris, I believe, right? She plays Chris?
I think so.
Okay.
And that character was the one that had a son out of wedlock, and she talks about her character, how she portrays it, acting out her impulses and regrets, and what she was able to take away from it, from this experience.
All right, so here is Emma from Dancing at Lufnasa. She plays Chris.
My character sort of starts off in a rut, because I think she's frustrated with a lot of things in her life that haven't gone the way that she hoped. I mean, like most of the sisters. But it's especially taken out on Michael or her sisters and their relationship with Michael, and I think that's sort of the main element of my story, her story, yeah.
Is there one side of her that you particularly relate with?
I think there's definitely qualities within her that a lot of people can relate to. I think there's an impulsiveness, but there's an instant regret when she, I wouldn't say like has an outburst, but when she acts on those impulses of frustration, I think there's this two-sidedness to her that makes her very human in regards to the fact that she has this regret, and she doesn't really go after people to be cruel or mean. It's just part of her, I think, survival techniques in order to get through the day and not face truly how hurt she is by her experiences so far. And I think just getting that feisty aspect of myself and really tease it out, and just really being able to act on those impulses and fully commit to the frustration with my surroundings and the given circumstances and the events that happen within the play. So just really focusing also on that two-sidedness. So there's that frustration that I think, you know, as functioning people, we try to stifle that. And you know, we keep our jobs, we keep our friends, we don't like act out on them all the time. But you know, there's also this two-sidedness. She acts out, and there's this regret. So it's sort of this balancing act between, you know, this character we want her to be liked, like all the characters, and to just show the frustration, I think, would defeat that purpose. So also highlighting just how she regrets her actions almost immediately after she acts on those impulses, I think helps carry that through. Just really focusing on relationship and just how multifaceted human relationship is and how complex. And I think that exploration as an actor is, there is no end to that exploration, which I think makes it really interesting. And to just take that exploration and find the joy in that and continue on with hopefully the other shows that are in my future. So yeah, I think working on relationships with other actors, other characters, and also the multifacetedness of myself as well.
Now, you were talking to them at the actual set,
yes,
right? And what did it look like? How is it come in?
It was very elaborate. It's pretty rustic, I'd say. There are these like huge wooden beams in the middle of the air, and it was really nice. The director was talking about how they would do certain things at one place, and that kind of separates the two ideologies or ideas or concepts kind of spatially, and that was the idea behind that.
And you had give us the information about the showing, and then you had another event you wanted to plug as well, right?
Yep. So if you want to find out more about Dancing at Lufnasa, you can go on their website at www.theater.ubc.ca/dancing at Lufnasa. And it already started playing on November 14th, and it's going all the way till December 1st at the Frederick Wood Theater. So if you haven't had a chance to check it out, you should definitely do so. I heard it was like a full house on one of the, like today or something, yeah. So you should definitely check it out. And also, there's this other theater project. It's called Changing the Lens. It's basically about using theater to address important social issues, and it's a student initiative that's targeted at the entire campus. Their tagline is, "Ever get tired of being asked where are you really from?" And they're looking for participants from the entire UBC community to be part of this theater workshop and to devise a play about the central theme of cultural identity and assumptions. If you would like to find out more,